in this Dixieland band. Dixieland is football music. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've been blessed. We played from Boston to Honolulu. Mm-hmm. You know, we opened for Guy Lombardo. We opened for Bob Hope. And the thing is, we're not any good. But nobody knows that. You remember what Samuel Johnson said about a woman preacher. It's like a dog who walks on two legs. She doesn't have to do it very well. The fact that she does it at all is quite remarkable. And so we've got this Robert Ripley value because when we're on that bandstand, there's not a person on this campus of any age who doesn't know somebody in the band, mm-hmm. you know.
And the we is Geriatric Six?
Geriatric Six plus One, yeah.
How'd that first come about, that group?
I was asked. They were doing a Roaring Twenties party at the faculty club, and they asked if I could get a band together. I called H. Owen Reed and Sandy Sandifer, two old men. Owen was born in 1910. He will be 91 this June. Sandy was born in February of 05. He would have been 96 this past February. But they both been presidents of the club and they couldn't say no. And we were terrible. Jeez, we were terrible. I often say, I hate to talk in superlatives, but we were the worst band I ever heard. I spoke at Sandy's funeral. No, I did speak at Sandy's funeral, but 10 years later I spoke at his wife's funeral, Louise Sandifer. Sandy had been dean of admissions at Ohio University. He was assistant head of dean of natural science here. And I said that for the last 10 years, Sandy has been in heaven, and Owen Reed's been in a very, very, very hot place. He's in Green Valley, Arizona. But man, did that stop him? Because I don't do anything but comedy, and I happen to do a lot of funerals, including Russ's, for that matter. And I just talk the way I talk. Anyway, and this is one of the reasons I'm a band leader, because I can do fancy patter, you know. I don't know, what were we talking about?
We were talking about that, how the group got started.
Oh, the group got started.
What year was it?
70.
1970.
Mm-hmm. And people say, how long have you been together? I said, we've never been together. But we learned to stop and start and corner together now. We played a thing at the faculty club. I brought in Dick Haggerty from Detroit. I couldn't continue to do that. Mm-hmm. I brought in Marshall McNutt, who's a great musician, just happened to be running the Christian Science students' dorm here while he was getting a PhD. But he's the guy whose solo you hear on Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. He's just a terrific trumpet. I had Owen Brainerd, who's the late Owen Brainerd, who's a abstract expressionist painter. And I don't know who else I had. I don't think I had anybody on bass. I used Gene Rebick, who was playing at the dance. But people loved the band. And they said, when are you coming back? And I said, there is no band. There is no band. And they said, what is your name? And there was a group called the Young Americans. So I figured we'd be the Geriatric Six. But I was 43 when I founded the Geriatric Six, you know. Don Thornburg was in his 30s. Don's the only guy still in his 60s now, I think. We're in our 70s. And we've gotten so we know a couple of things. And we play all right. We've put up tapes and records and television shows and CDs. And the guys are now convinced that we're good. And as there is no way of disciplining a band made up of seven retired millionaires, you know. First of all, they're never in the country. We're playing on the 9th of April, and right now, Milt Powell's walking in Patagonia somewhere, Bill Fuss just got back from Africa. Jim Smith is in Sarasota, Florida. And why not? You know, retirement system, Michigan State University, has been aptly called the revenge of the nerds. You know, we're all very, very comfortable. And we're no longer bad, I guess. But I guess we could rehearse, but I think guys would start quitting. I just don't know. I just call a tune and we play. And I'll sometimes be on stage. I was playing a Christmas party 3 years ago for some senior citizen group out of Waverly, anyway. And I said, this is the tune first sung by Pharaoh's daughter. And the guys didn't know what it was. And I said, it's I Found a New Baby. You know. But I'll do this. I will say, this is the Acid Rain song. I make a date for golf and you can bet your ass it rains.
What were some of the traditions that the band developed, or at least within the university?
Yeah, we all play in the same key.
That's a tradition.
We dress really nattily because it's Bill's idea and he's a sociologist and he knows that if you dress alike, people will think you know each other. You know?
You're a band.
You're a real band. We play free at all the football games. We play at the football games as a concert. And for all those years, we had really bad football teams. People used to come, listen to us play for 2 hours and then go home. George Perlis loved us. And George would do great things. He would take us everywhere. We started playing away at Northwestern because nobody came to the Northwestern game, and there was no sense bringing a 300-piece band to that stadium because it would outnumber the audience, you know, like 3-1. So we went there. Well, damn if it doesn't turn out. The highest paid man on the Northwestern faculty died recently in St. Petersburg, Russia. Head of research at the medical school, Norbert Frankel. Norby and I played together with the Princeton Tigers when we were children. The provost there was a man named Ray Mack, a really good big band drummer who had worked with Bill. And so we would go to Northwestern, and then we'd go over to the provost's house, which was a real mansion. And instead of eating off of paper plates, as people do, we'd have silver, you know, china and crystal. And we would play far into the evening. It was a real Jack Oakey scene, you know. And we liked going to Chicago because the wives would go into town. Sometimes they'd come to the football game. But you know, you walk in and out of the football game. It's like football games at at Carlton, you know, where it doesn't cost any money and you walk in and you walk out. Anyway, we played in, and over the years you get, but hell, we've been playing together now for 31 years, we know exactly, it was originally like four guys singing in the back of a car, you know, you had to keep out of the other guy's way in harmony, but now I know what everybody's going to do, and they know what I'm going to do, and I don't think we're going to make jazz history ever, but we're part of MSU history, you know.
How did the first recording come about?
Guys wanted to make a record. It was ego. Mm-hmm. What I've got there is the president of the North Central States Sociological Association, the dean of veterinary medicine. You know, these are all guys who are everybody but me was ambitious, you know. We've got winners of Guggenheims and Fulbrights and, you know, guys all pretty famous in their field. And they decided one day that we played well enough to make a record. And So we went over to Bob Baldauri's studio at...
Is that in East Lansing?
No, it's in Okemos.
Okemos. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Bob still has a studio. He probably does. I think he made our second album, too. Then we started recording at Michigan State, up in that Com Arts building. It's an ego thing. We send them out at Christmas to our friends, and they tell us it's good, because if they don't, they won't get another one. Guys who are really modest about what they do well are not modest about what they're doing in competition with 17-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I think we do play jazz better than we played when we were 17. I think jazz does some things that basketball doesn't. You know, at basketball you play worse at 70, no matter how bad, you know. There are certain things that 17-year-olds do better than 70-year-olds. They look better with their clothes off. They just do. They just do. And that's why they do it. Well, that's one of the reasons they do. Jazz is something you learn. We all play now better than we did before. We play together a lot better than we did.
What was your maybe biggest gig that you had?
Oh, our biggest gig was playing at the Hollywood Palladium. We'd gone out for the Rose Bowl, and there was this party, and there was a very good band on stage, but we knocked them out because they had written a jazz version of the MSU fight song they thought was pretty good. But we play the fight song, you know, a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's something we do play pretty well. It is genuine Dixie, and it's genuine MSU fight. And it took us a couple of years to get it right. But I now like that song. As an English major, I hate to see we will fight. No, Spartan teams are sure to win. They're fighting with a vim. Rah, rah, rah. But Clash of the Michigan Princeton song says, we're fighting. They also said, we will fight with a vim that is dead sure to win for old Nassau. Not only that, both songs starts out crash right through that line of blue. One was for Ann Arbor, one was for New Haven. We now say crush right through for MSU, but you couldn't do it when we were at MSC. that was our biggest gig. And, but we played weddings up on Mackinac Island, and we opened up that new golf course up north, whatever that's called. And we played for the opening of the Civic Center downtown, the opening for the Breslin Center. I played, the guys didn't, but I played for the opening of the Civic building that they just tore down downtown.
The older Civic Center.
Yeah, the older Civic Center. That was January 1st, early January of 56. So I'm always in on the foundation. And when you're playing, everybody knows you. You know, I spoke last Tuesday at the Methodist Church here, and somebody says, I know you from somewhere. Do you sing in a choir? That's, we get up, we say, show me the way to go home at the football game. They thought I sang in a choir. Well, because I was talking at a church. You know.
How has the... How did the alumni receive the band?
Oh, the alumni love this. I was the first. It's no longer true that I'm the only. I was the first non-alumnus to be on the board of directors of the Alumni Association. It happened because I wanted to get work for the Geriatric Six. That really didn't turn out. But I like these guys. In 79, I won the Distinguished Faculty Award. I said to my wife, I said, sweetheart, and nobody in the world deserves this less than me. And I got a list of absolutely wonderful people who had not won it. Many of them still haven't won it and won't because they're retired. I said, this is ridiculous. It only paid $1,000 those days. It pays $3,000. I said, I can't take this money. She says, they're going to give it to you. What are you going to do? So I said, I'll give it back to the university in various ways. And one of the ways was I took a lifetime membership in the Alumni Association, which was open to non-alumni. This is before this trouble between Cecil Mackey and the Alumni Association. Mm-hmm. So they probably threw my money away. Anyway, but then I was on the, I got alumni publications and they asked for nominations for the board of directors and I nominated myself saying, listen, I've been here forever and I thought I could help my band. I really didn't, but I got to do some wonderful things. I sat on a three-person committee. In fact, I chaired the committee that gives $500 scholarships to 10 high school seniors. I sat on the committee that gives the alumni award to undergraduate teachers. It's the only award now for undergraduate teaching because Michigan State has become a place where all professors are independent contractors. They bring in money from outside, and the guys who bring in the most money and the most fame get the awards. I don't think I'd ever gotten an award except a crazy kind of fame I have as a comic and a musician. Mm-hmm. But I just got off the board. This past Christmas was my last meeting. In fact, I didn't go to it because the meeting was in Owosso and it was snowing. It was just before Christmas because we spent Christmas in Los Angeles. But we left Los Angeles on about the 28th. It was 83 degrees. We got back here. It was 17 below. It was 100 degrees difference. And I started oiling my watch with Tropartic. Okay.
Let's talk about the voice library.
Okay.
How did you become the director of the...
Like everything else, a crazy series of lucky breaks. I was teaching at Justin Morrill College. I was teaching on, of course, on humor. It strikes me that there's some humor that you have to listen to, you can't read, you know. There's some that you got to look at. And I did some visual. I wanted to do strictly auditory, because everybody who did comedy on radio had a signature line, you know, you want to buy a duck, or and everybody would laugh, or hoo-ha, or whatever, you know. Very interesting. I went in to see Bob Vincent, who had just come here from California. He was a very old man. In fact, he was older than he said. He was born in 98, and he always claimed to have been born in the year 00 because he wanted to be the youngest person to fight in the war. He was in the British Army in 1914, you know. But I went to see Bob and I said, I feel that there's some humor that is just signature audio. And, oh, yes, he said. Bob was a kind of a hermit of a guy. He didn't talk to many people. He really didn't. He didn't like anybody. He certainly didn't like librarians. You know, he thought that they were, because he had rubbed elbows with the famous all of his life. He really had. And he had done interviews with W.C. Handy and Robert Jackson, you know, at the Nuremberg trials. He was, in fact, our sound man at the Nuremberg trials. He speaks German as well as he speaks English. His father was a colleague of Sigmund Freud, a student and then a colleague. I went to see Bob, and they said, as I used to say of Nobody goes to see Harry Kimber. Nobody goes to see Bob Vincent. I'm too dumb to know this. I just went up and I said, would you like to be able... Well, he put together a thing that started with Weber and Fields and wound up where if you hear a certain voice saying a certain kind of thing, the disparity... And he had Art Linkletter talking very dirty. And it was great. He was at the Friars Club luncheon and he said, I don't know what I'm doing with you guys. He says, I was born in wedlock, he says. And, it's just very funny. He says, I told my mother-in-law, sweet, sweet old lady that I was going to talk here. And she said, you dumb son of a bitch. And, this was just great stuff. And shortly thereafter, as luck would have it, Mutual Radio asked him to do, or he asked them, but they said the format would be, if he was going to do a half-hour show, radio show, they would like to have him talking to somebody. And they would like it to be a kind of polymath, but who knew less than he did. You know, so I would say, well, Mr. Wizard, what are we going to do today? So we're going to do baseball, or we're going to do atomic scientists or something. And I said, gee whiz, do you have Tris Speaker, you know, a three-fingered Mordecai Brown or whatever, Albert Einstein. They said, of course, young fellow. We did these shows, and Bob would have a script, and I would just sit and respond. See? So he would say things like, I think Fanny Bryce was actually better than Barbara Streisand. I would say Barbara Streisand wins by a nose. He'd go right on. See? He was talking once about Cock Robin. I don't know how the hell it came up. He's talking about Cock Robin. I said, that's not his real name. I said, his name is Penis Rabinowitz. So I was doing this. I was doing this for Bob, and he was cutting it out because he had something he wanted to do, but he had to have me. Mm-hmm. And we had a great deal of fun. As I say, he's a man who didn't like many people.
Did you record any of those shows?
I've got the outtakes. When I took over his job, he sent me these outtakes. We did that show. Bob was over age when he retired. He had been hired. Dick Chapin had said to him, come to Mission Center, I'll give you a lifetime job. Bob did not know at Michigan State a lifetime ends at 70. Dick did not know that Bob was immortal. He was 70, he's actually 76 when somebody came up and some man from Texas who was getting his PhD at the University of Pennsylvania in Malcolm X. He was writing about Malcolm X. He's a black man. And he came to see Vincent. He came in the office and said, I'd like to speak to Bob Vincent. And Bob said to him, I'm sorry, Mr. Vincent's in California. Bob's picture had just been in the New York Times, you know, and nobody looks like Bob, you know. He's 4'11" and cute and all. He went down to see Henry Koch, and he said, I just talked to Mr. Vincent. He said, what did he say? He said, Mr. Vincent's in California. It was exacerbated by the fact that this man was poor. He'd come out this distance. He was black. He complained to the head. And so they told Bob that his age was now a factor, that he retired. Bob was a whiz at what he did. He was very, very, very good. But this is the kind of thing he would do when he didn't want to be bothered. Dick Chapin asked me if I wanted to run the voice. I said, I don't think about that. No. I said, no. I said, I've got a great job. I'm I teach sophomores who love me. I'm doing the kind of thing I want to do, and I know. And he says, well, I don't know, anybody knows what's in that collection. We'll shut it down. And then he appealed to my greed, which was crazy. He said, well, I'll put you on a 12-month contract and give you a lot of money, which he really didn't. It was a lot of money for a librarian. I always made a lot of money for a librarian, but I didn't make a lot of money for a PhD. That's when I learned that a PhD in English isn't the worst paid man on campus. But I liked the job. About 95% of the stuff in that library is stuff that I brought in, mainly from phoning people, from trading. I didn't have a budget. I had no real moral or economic support from the library. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know what they expected me to do, but I through barter and theft and other things, and working very hard at home at night on weekends, I got lots and lots and lots and lots of stuff. And I wound up doing things I wouldn't have done. I would never be a Book of the Month Club author if I hadn't been.
Mm-hmm. How'd that come about?
Got a call from the Book of the Month Club. Oh. I said, I'm sorry, I don't want to join. They said, no, listen, hear me out. He says, we want to do a thing, a series on presidents. That's what they had planned. And I said, well, I'll put together the voices. He says, no, would you write the book? And I said, sure. I tried to get Steve Jensen to be the announcer, but Clifton Fadiman read the script, and he was chairman of the board, and he said, no, I want to do this. So Clifton Fadiman did it. I got that thing back, and I listened, and I said, my God, they've made that so wonderful. I looked at it, and he followed my script precisely. It was just, it was like Richard Burton reading it, you know. And then I read a little booklet for it. But it didn't sell worth a damn. What happened is it was put up for a Grammy for historical recordings. And the thing that won that year was George Simon's Smithsonian History of Jazz. I said, all of the people who voted were musicians, and that's what I would have voted for. But they thought that what would win was an Elvis Presley retrospective. I get a call from the Associated Press, and I very seldom make the national news, a couple times in a lifetime. And this guy calls up and he says, do you see any relationship between Franklin D. Roosevelt and Elvis Presley? What you're taught in graduate school is you say yes, and then you make up, you stall. So I said, of course. I said, Franklin Delano Roosevelt electrified every guitar in the Tennessee Valley. I said, rendering talent unnecessary. Well, that went out everywhere. And I sat up and listened to the Grammys, but I didn't expect to win. I didn't. But being nominated for a Grammy is plenty. You know, who the hell? You know, who am I? You know. It's enough. It isn't enough when you're Robert Goulet to say I was nominated for a Grammy, but when you're a little guy teaching at the State Agricultural School, that's fine.
What were the raw materials that you had to work with?
I used about 60 or 70 speeches of Roosevelt's out of maybe 110 that we had. Mm-hmm.
These were ones that Bob Vincent had collected, or had he taken them himself?
The wonderful thing about Presidents of the United States is as President of the United States speaking ex cathedra is copyright free. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of albums of Roosevelt that you take it from, but you don't have to pay the album either because mm-hmm. they got it from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt said so many things, you know, rendezvous with destiny and nothing to fear but fear itself. He was It's like Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, every fifth line is a quotable one. And I did them in chronological order. I did the Depression, the Dust Bowl, the War, and it was a three-volume thing. And Clifton Fadiman was wonderful, and I had the chance to write. And I wouldn't have done that. Lord knows what I'd have done if I hadn't gone into the voice. I'd have done something because I had nervous energy. Mm-hmm. Although I got to tell you, I'm retired. I'm not doing anything now. I'm just screwing around.
We'll change the tape.
Okay.